Welcome back to Blueprint for Wealth. I'm Wayne Zell, and with me today is my special guest, Steve Shannon. Welcome, Steve.
Thanks for having me on the show, Wayne.
Thanks for being a special guest. Steve's going to be a recurring guest because he is my partner at Odin, Feldman & Pittleman, and we'll have words of wisdom on litigation matters as we go forward during the year, and we'll bring him in for any special content and ideas on how to deal with your litigation issues. He's a principal of the firm and a member of the firm's litigation practice group. He's been recognized as one of the Virginia legal elite since 2007 in Virginia Business Magazine and has an extensive litigation practice. Steve, you'll tell us about that in a second. And he's a former state prosecutor. He's currently an adjunct professor at George Mason Law. And most notably, he was a delegate with the Virginia General Assembly all the way from 2004 to 2010, unfortunately lost in his bid for attorney general last year for the state of Virginia, but maybe we'll see him again in Virginia politics. And welcome, Steve. Tell us a little bit about your practice, your litigation practice at Odin, Feldman & Pittleman.
Well, most of my clients have matters in state court, so I handle both civil litigation, usually for small to mid-sized businesses, and then we've got a pretty sizable criminal defense practice as well. I had been a prosecutor for several years in Fairfax before getting elected to the General Assembly. We've got about 55 attorneys, so we're the largest Fairfax-based law firm. And you know, our attorneys every day are in the Northern Virginia courts, and that's sort of our comfort zone.
Right. So in terms of litigation, you do both civil and criminal. And but the firm has been involved in some pro bono activities of recent note. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. We're participating in a program that was started by the Legal Services of Northern Virginia called the Pro Bono Attorney for the Day program. And what that program is, Wayne, it focuses on victims of domestic violence. Basically, if the police show up at somebody's home because there's been an assault on a family member, usually the police will take somebody, oftentimes it's a wife or the woman living in the house, and take her to get an emergency protective order. And then within 2 weeks, there will be a permanent protective order hearing. And the problem that a lot of victims of domestic violence run into is that they don't have an attorney to represent them for the permanent protective order hearing. So the Attorney for the Day program tries to get an attorney to commit to one particular day each month to represent whomever's whoever has a case in the Fairfax Juvenile and Domestic Relations Court that day. We've got about five of our attorneys working on this, and right now in Fairfax, through this program, the attorneys in the bar have committed to about 75% of the monthly docket. So we've got about 25% to go. It's been hugely successful. Alexandria is starting it right now, and we're really hoping that what we're doing in Fairfax can serve as a pilot program for bars across the state.
That's a wonderful thing that that you all are doing. And it's pro bono, meaning that these are people that just don't have the money to afford a lawyer, and it's a very important matter that you're handling for them.
That's right. It's means tested. So, you know, we're not representing millionaires in court.
Right.
These are people who, you know, find themselves in a terrible situation, and they need a helping hand. And it's really important that while we're all members of law firms, and you know, law firms are businesses, we're also a profession. And in the context of being part of a profession, it means you need to give back to the community. And I think this is a very worthy endeavor for us to participate in.
I agree. I couldn't agree with you more. And thank you for doing that for all the people in Fairfax County and now all the jurisdictions around the area that are going to utilize legal services that are being provided pro bono. Before we move on to, I think, a topic of interest that we wanted to discuss, I did have a question for you. You were a delegate for the Virginia General Assembly for many years. You served on several committees there. What was your favorite moment as a delegate to the Virginia General Assembly? What brings back fond memories?
The thing I enjoyed most about being a state delegate was being able to help constituents. You know, there are really two prongs of being in the General Assembly. One is you go down to Richmond 2 to 3 months a year and you work on budget related issues, or you consider legislation that will result in changes to the code of Virginia. The other 9 or 10 months of the year, you're in your district and there are people in your community who are asking for your help with regard to trying to get a government service, or you know, they're having a problem with regard to trying to get something done, and they need somebody to step up. There's nothing more satisfying than when you're able to help a neighbor or somebody in your community resolve a problem that they can't otherwise resolve themselves, because basically what they're doing is they're entrusting you with something that's really important to them. And so, you know, when I would door knock, I'd run into families and they'd say, oh, you know, thank you so much for helping my father a couple years ago. It meant a tremendous amount to our family. And those are the kinds of little things that make the job so rewarding.
So you can help them at the state level in your capacity as a delegate.
Yeah, that's the name of the game.
That's pretty neat. I didn't realize how much individualized help you could give to your constituents, and thank you for your service, you know, for six long years. But then you tried to transition into the attorney general position. It didn't succeed, but you still have an interest in state politics. And I know one of the areas that you've been particularly focused on is the governor's effort to privatize the ABC boards.
Yes.
Tell us about your involvement with that and what's going on with that today. We haven't heard much about it.
Right. So our firm has an administrative law practice. So we, you know, we represent people or entities at the state level and at the federal level. And the big issue over the past year in Virginia was whether or not to privatize Virginia's liquor stores. Mm-hmm. We don't have any clients who have any particular interest in this, but because of my background and expertise with regard to the legislative process, I've been asked to speak to national groups with regard to what happened. And basically what happened is it's an interesting case of the politics sounding good and the policy sounding bad. You know, the idea was to try to generate money for transportation projects by selling off Virginia's liquor monopoly, which has been in effect for 77 years. The difficulty is that monopoly generates about $120 million for the state general fund, which pays for education, which pays for health and human services, which pays for public safety.
Every year.
Every year. And you can't, we just could not figure out how to hold the general fund harmless, mm-hmm. while at the same time generating new money for transportation. There were too many assumptions in a bad economy to the point where, you know, nobody wanted to vote on this. I mean, three guys in the legislature out of 140 were willing to put their name onto two bills, but nobody would vote on the bills themselves. And I think privatization probably is going to go nowhere. It sounded good, you know, on the political trail, but you just can't figure out right now how to make the numbers work, and it really looks like it may be a money loser if you sell the monopoly. The idea was to try to sell off the 334
stores,
and then to multiply the number of stores by three, so you would have 1,000 stores being run by private retailers, and it was just too difficult to try to make the numbers work.
So the price at which they would sell these franchises off to the liquor store owners would not justify the loss of revenue on an annual basis for the general fund, $120 million. What about the taxes, you know, the taxes that they could generate from the sale of liquor in these stores?
Well, what's really fascinating is, we deal with in our practice, when we deal with a lot of family-owned businesses that are focused on trying to build up and then to sell their company.
Right.
It is really difficult to value a public asset, and that's where a number of the assumptions come into play. How much is this monopoly worth? And in order to make the numbers work, the idea was, well, let's create an auction system, mm-hmm. A market mechanism, and then people will bid for the licenses. The problem with that is that the big box shops, the big box stores, had an enormous advantage because of their resources. So the concern was that these huge companies were going to buy all the retail licenses, and so the mom and pop shops would be run out of business.
Huh.
So then the idea was, well, let's create a tiered structure. So, you know, if your business is X size, you're guaranteed a certain number of licenses that you can bid for. If you're a larger company, then, you know, there's a set
fewer,
number for them.
Fewer number of licenses, right?
The problem with that is, as you might be able to realize, is that when you start creating this tiered structure, the smaller companies are going to presumably have lower bids.
Right.
You know, the really big companies are going to be able to put a lot of skin in the game.
Right.
And when you do that, you create greater financial uncertainty. Remember that we've got a good thing going with regard to $120 million in profits per year going into the general fund. So that's what you're putting at risk.
Well, I mean, in using valuation modeling, you would say, well, I need to be able to generate $120 million into perpetuity or more for the state on an annual basis.
As a guarantee.
As a guarantee.
Right.
And so what you would have to do is, if you sold off one of these stores, you'd also have to retain some kind of flow, like a franchisor would, in my opinion, so that there would be a constant flow of revenue coming back to the state on an annual basis based on the gross revenues that are being generated. But what you're saying is the analysis went on and the money just wasn't there.
Yeah, well, the governor was never able to get to the number of $500 million for transportation.
So he wanted to raise not only $120 million a year to replace the general fund, but also $500 million additional.
Yes, revenue. So $120 million in perpetuity plus $500 million for transportation. And the assumptions, the most he ever got to was $300 million. But mm-hmm. The assumptions were what really concerned folks. And the assumptions relate to the differences between trying to value a public asset versus trying to value a private asset. It's easier to value a private asset because there are various models. But you alluded to a couple things. First of all, what is the tax sensitivity associated with selling liquor when the bulk of alcohol profits come from a certain region of the state, Northern Virginia? What does it mean when alcohol is relatively less expensive to buy in Maryland or DC. In DC or right. in West Virginia? All of the contiguous states in the District of Columbia sell liquor at a lower sales price than we do. So if you assume, well, we'll just make up the money by raising taxes, what will be the effect of people going into the District of Columbia or Maryland to buy liquor and then going back into Northern Virginia?
Although Maryland just announced yesterday an increase in their alcohol tax.
Right, up to
9%. 9%. So, right. I mean, you know, I guess everybody's thirsting for revenue and they need to replace lost revenues as a result of the economic downturn.
So. Right, but it deals with the elasticity situation. And
so how much can you charge for the product? And then on top of that, how much can you charge in terms of taxes?
That's right. And you know, at the end of the day, we've got a good, clean system. We've got a reputation with regard to the way that we sell liquor in Virginia that is seen as honest. It's worked for 77 years. And so the philosophical argument that, well, we should, you know, government shouldn't be in the business of selling alcohol, it didn't really resonate. You know, the public right now is not really into theoretical arguments. They see that every state has a budget crunch. All of our families are, you know, we're all tightening our belts. The public right now is focused on dollars and cents, and they want to see government working in a fiscally responsible manner. And when you've got $120 million per year that's going into paying for, you know, kids' education, paying for human services, paying for public safety, they don't want to give up that freight unless they know that by selling this public asset, they will more than be able to make up for that. And the numbers just weren't there to create any sort of confidence, at least with regard to 137 out of 140 legislators.
Well, it's sad to hear that, because we need that money for transportation in Northern Virginia. Hopefully we'll find it from another source.
Yeah, it's a you know, this is not a partisan issue. The idea of selling liquor stores was first proposed in Virginia in 1992 by Governor Wilder,
who's
a Democrat. And so I think that, you know, the issue of trying to get more money for transportation is one that has vexed governors, both Democrat and Republican alike. And so, you know, I applaud the governor for searching to trying to find money for transportation. But you know, to use the phrase that I've heard downstate many times, a dog just isn't hunting.
Well, we're talking with Steve Shannon, principal at Odin, Feldman & Pittleman. Steve, what's your phone number so people can call you?
703-218-2130.
And it's been great having you as a guest on Blueprint for Wealth.
Thanks for having me, Wayne.
Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you next week.